Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your solo host today, Monica Hadley. And our guest on Writers' Voices today is Gina DeMillo Wagner, who is an award-winning journalist and author. Her writing has been featured in the New York Times, the Washington Post, Memoir Magazine, and many others. She is a winner of the Kraft Creative Nonfiction Award, and her memoir was longlisted for the 2022 SFWP Literary Prize. Gina has a master's degree in journalism and is co-founder of Watershed Creative Writing and Art Workshop. She lives and works near Boulder, Colorado. And the book that we're talking about today is her memoir, Forces of Nature, a memoir of family, loss, and finding home. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Gina.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So I'm looking at you, although our listeners won't be able to see you. And you're not very old. I mean, you're not young, but, you know, what made you decide you were old enough to write a memoir, put it that way?
You know, I think events happen in your life that necessitate the writing. But as you mentioned, I've been a professional writer for 20 years. So it wasn't a huge leap to write a book. And ultimately, what prompted me to write the memoir was two things. One, I wrote an essay for the New York Times about my experience being a sibling to someone who had some profound disabilities, and that resonated a lot with people who had previously not really heard that story. And the other inspiration was really that I wrote the book that I wish that I had had when I was going through the loss of my brother. And the story that I wish I'd had that kind of would have validated my experience as a sibling.
So tell us about your brother.
My older brother, Alan, had a rare genetic disability called Prader-Willi syndrome. And there's a lot of things that are characteristic with Prader-Willi, but one of the big things is these violent mood swings. He could be extremely loving and gentle one minute, and then really terrifying the next. Another characteristic is an insatiable appetite. So he couldn't control himself around food and didn't have the internal cues that you and I have to tell us when we're full. So there was a lot of behavioral issues. And when he died suddenly at age 43, I was left with some questions. The biggest question was what happened. I think a lot of people can identify with that. If you lose somebody really suddenly and unexpectedly, you want to know what went wrong. But because of his intellectual disabilities, I also wondered things like, did he know that I loved him? Could he feel that love? Did he understand that people could fear him but also love him at the same time? And some of those questions had answers and some did not. And the memoir is really me writing toward those questions. And what I discovered is that the question of what happened to my brother is really a question of what happened to me and what happened to us growing up.
Which was, you did not have an easy time.
Right.
And in some sense, your brother's condition, maybe was the root of a lot of the problems, but he wasn't actually to blame for them.
Right. Yeah, that's an important distinction. Yeah. I think I knew even at a young age, I understood that he could not control his behavior. He did not want to be violent. He didn't want to hurt me. You know, I think I understood that there was something going on in his body that was beyond his control.
And your parents weren't really up to the task.
Yeah. my mother had, I'm laughing because it's an understatement, right?
Yeah. I mean, it obviously is. And I mean, writing about what you endured as a young girl was sort of brought me to tears a couple of times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, my mother had untreated mental illness, and my parents split when I was about 5 or 6. So I really had to step up and be the other parent in the household. And I took care of not just my brothers, but also my mother.
And you also had a younger brother whom you were trying to protect.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I think sometimes people who write memoirs maybe resent this question, which is how the people in your family that you're writing about, how they reacted to the fact that you're writing a memoir, whether they were supportive or not. And often they're much more supportive than one might expect.
Yeah, I mean, I get this question a lot. You know, I have family members that are very supportive of the, you know, the accomplishment of writing a book. And I understand that question. I mean, I understand the curiosity around it.
Yeah.
But what I want to say for me personally is that to answer that question would center their experience, which is something that I did my whole life. You know?
Right, right.
So at the end of the day, I like to think it's not my business what they think of it.
Exactly, exactly. Now, however, as you're writing, you probably were thinking about that. And it's a question that every memoirist has to face. Can I be completely honest about my story? And, you know, the answer is yes, you can. But it's hard, isn't it?
It is. I think one of your tasks as a memoir author is to determine the boundaries. I kind of think of it as setting guardrails around where my story ends and someone else's story begins. So, you know, obviously I'm centering my experience and my relationship with Alan and making meaning of that. And that's going to include other people. But I made some very deliberate, conscious decisions around where I would kind of have those boundaries so that I wouldn't be creeping into other people's perspectives and other people's stories.
Was that something that, I mean, how did you learn to do that?
Honestly, I think my journalism training has been really helpful. I approached the memoir kind of as an investigative journalist. I did a lot of research. I pulled public documents and interviewed people and went through old diaries and photographs. And so anything that could be verified, I verified. And then in terms of just kind of determining the boundaries of the story, I mapped the structure of the memoir. And then, you know, as you're writing, there's just a little bit of like a gut check, you know, like, am I creeping into something that I really shouldn't be speaking about? I didn't really have a lot of fear around protecting people's feelings, but I also knew that I was erring on the side of privacy. I changed names, I changed some details, and I kept it really centered on mine and my brother's relationship.
Now, in the book, you're going back and forth between basically starting from the receiving the news that your brother had died, and then you're flashing back to your childhood. When you were writing, did you write it more chronologically? Or I'm just curious how it went from, you know, how you got to the end structure in terms of chronology.
Yeah, it was tricky. I don't really think I wrote it chronologically to begin with. I saw from the very beginning, I saw these parallels between what was happening in the aftermath of Alan's death and things that were that happened in our childhood. So for me, the layers kind of fit from the beginning. And so the back and forth, it wasn't like I was taking one complete narrative and chopping it up. I was kind of tying together these threads that already, to me, were connected, if that makes sense.
Sure, sure. At what point did you say, I'm going to write about my brother? Where was it, like, after he died immediately, you thought, I need to write about this, or did it take some time?
It took some time. Well, I'll say that I wrote about it immediately for my own benefit. It took some time before I realized that this was going to be a book that I would want to send out into the world to potentially help other people. But yeah, I was writing, I was journaling from the beginning just for my own benefit.
Is that something you've always done, is journaling?
It is, yeah. Yeah, there's some childhood journals that I've lost over the years that I would love to get
Oh, I
back.
bet. Did you have any of them to refer to when you were writing this?
I had the ones from the moment I moved out as a teenager onward, those journals I've kept over the years.
Yeah, that was one of the kind of tragic things in the story was when you tried to get those from your mother and the ones from your childhood and just,
Yes.
yeah.
The ones that were lost in the
Yeah,
flood.
yes, yeah.
Yeah, there was a really epic flood in Boulder in 2013, I believe. And yeah, a box of my keepsakes were that my mother had been holding on to and not had, I'd asked for but had not received, were lost during that flood.
Would you like to read a little bit from Forces of Nature for us?
Sure. I have a short passage I can read.
Great.
This is a flashback. It's actually one of my earliest memories of my brother Alan, and one of my only memories of all of us together as a family. Atlanta, Georgia, summer of 1979. We are underwater. The voices of neighborhood children drift above us, muffled. We exist in a sea of chlorinated blue. I am treading water for the first time without my swimmies, those inflatable armbands that keep toddlers afloat. I'm dunking my body down and clawing my way back to the surface. I am proud of this achievement. Nearby, Alan is diving to the bottom of the pool, collecting shiny pennies that my dad tossed in as a game. He lines them up evenly on the concrete edge. My mother is lounging on a plastic chaise in the shade, far enough away that our splashes won't dampen her freshly set curls, but close enough to watch us swim. Baby Will is asleep next to her on a striped beach towel. The air smells like burnt hot dogs and cocoa butter. Alan is confident and graceful. He is upside down. He is spinning. He is pumping his legs and propelling his body through the water. He is pushing off the bottom and breaking through the pool surface like a torpedo. He's unconcerned with the rivulets of water flowing down his thick brown hair, over his forehead, and into his eyes. He refuses to wear goggles. He is laughing and squealing with delight. I am in awe. I want to do this too. Swimming is something Alan does better than me, and not just because he is six and I am three. Swimming is something he will always do better than me, like a superpower. My parents are watching us. They are smiling. They are clapping every time Alan breaks the surface. They're looking around the pool deck at other parents, making eye contact as if to say, "Do you see the miracle happening here?" They are proud of me, sure, but more than that, they are amazed at their son, who is limited in so many ways, speech impaired, lacking balance and muscle tone, and yet so strong and graceful in the pool. It's like the water washes away his disability. Underwater, I observe my brother in slow motion. He is suspended in space and time. Alan is unafraid. I am unafraid. And so, for a moment, my parents are unafraid too. For a moment, we are tethered by our devotion to Alan, our sense of pride, the notion that maybe things will be okay after all. In my memory, this is the closest I've been to reverence for an older sibling, the closest I felt to intense longing to be able to do something as well as he can. I'm too young to articulate it, but this experience instills in me a hope that will sustain me later in life when I need it most. A belief that things can be better, that family can be a source of love, of safety and happiness, not just fear, embarrassment, or pain.
Thank you. That is Gina DeMillo Wagner reading from Forces of Nature, a memoir of family, loss, and finding home. I'd say, would it be accurate to say that you always knew that your family was different?
It's an interesting question. I think I always knew that my brother and I were different. You know, he was 3 years older than me. And I understood at a young age that I was passing him by developmentally.
Right.
But no one ever sat me down and said, hey, you know, your brother has a disability and this is why he's different. There was never these overt conversations. And so it wasn't really until I think I started school and spent time at friends' houses that I understood that my home life was very different than theirs.
So you became kind of an adult in the family at a very early age. Is that something that I'm would assume that that has affected you your entire life, and in what ways?
It has. I mean, I think the biggest thing that I still deal with, although I want to say I've done a lot of therapy as an adult, and have gotten to a very healthy place, but I spent so much of my childhood bypassing my own needs and putting other people first that it has taken a long time for me to be able to identify my own needs. And I'm talking things as simple as identifying, okay, I'm hungry. What do I want to eat? You know, there's just some very basic needs that I had to learn how to tune into for myself.
Well, food was definitely an issue in your childhood because, as you mentioned, one of your brother's symptoms was an inability to even know if he was full, and so an insatiable appetite, which you write about how often he would eat all the food in the house. There was nothing left.
Right. Yeah.
And because your parents had divorced, your mother was struggling financially, that there wasn't money to go out and buy more food. Did you actually sometimes really go hungry?
Yeah, I definitely suffered some food insecurity growing up. I would eat lunch at school. In high school, I had friends that would bring me food from home, from their homes. So yeah, there were definitely times that, you know, we didn't have anything to eat, or I was, you know, pulling ingredients like flour out of the pantry and trying to like add water and make biscuits. And but ultimately, I think I learned, you know, to need less. If Alan was special needs and had these intense needs, then I kind of lived in opposition to that. I had no needs.
Wow. I would think it would have been very easy to end up having a eating disorder from that, but apparently that you didn't.
No, yeah, it was never about it was never about body image. My mother, you know, would diet. She had some body image issues, and you know, thankfully, I did not inherit that. It was more food for survival and trying to find food.
You know, you had so many obstacles growing up, so many things that you had to deal with, and yet you were successful in school. You got good grades. You didn't do drugs. What do you attribute that to, that you were able to function so apparently normally in such an abnormal situation?
It's actually a really common theme among siblings to people with disabilities, high achievements, doing really well at school. And I think one of the reasons for that is because if I felt invisible at home, if I felt unseen at home, school was a place where I could be seen and recognized. And one way to get recognition is to perform really well. So I was getting a lot of my needs met from teachers and from my classmates and friends at school. And an easy way to do that was to be a really good student.
I wonder sometimes if teachers realize how much of an impact they might be having on a student who has a troubled home life.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's some teachers I would love to go back and speak to.
Yeah. And you did have some people, you know, what I gather from reading the book was that you kind of thought as a child that you were hiding all the disarray and the chaos at home from the rest of the world. But there were some people that saw through it and did try and offer assistance, but not enough.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I was in a difficult position because, you know, I had my mother telling me that if I shared what was happening at home, that it would push her over the edge. She threatened suicide a lot. And so I kind of lived with this fear that if I tell people what's going on at home, then she's going to, you know, maybe harm herself. So, but yes, of course, I mean, especially in high school, when you're spending more time around friends and you're not, you know, you're not as under the thumb of your parents, mm-hmm. then people definitely saw things and noticed things. But yeah, it wasn't enough for any sort of meaningful intervention, except for the fact that I was sent to see a therapist who ended up being really wonderful.
Right. But I've got to admit, I was a little disappointed in the social worker.
Yes. Yeah, me too. Yeah. I mean, and it's, you know, I don't want to make excuses. I was at a public high school in Atlanta. You know, I suspect that social worker's caseload was enormous, and you know,
and there may have been kids who were in much more challenging
yes.
situations.
Yes.
Yeah.
Again, it's not an excuse, but I think to me it speaks to the brokenness of the system more than a failure of that one particular person.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, I can understand too the idea that they don't want to just lightly take people, kids out of their home, you know, without really good cause. Although in some ways it seems like there was some pretty good cause here. I don't know. It's just, I just feel like somebody should have. Did you have any grandparents that could have offered more help?
No, I mean, it's, again, it kind of goes to, I think, how isolated our family was, you know, and how much my mother created this culture of silence around it. It, you know, in recent years, I've had people, adults, family, extended family members say things like, I knew things weren't good, but I didn't know they were that bad, or, you know, and to me, that feels a little bit cautionary for all of us, because I think about the people that I encounter, you know, at my kids' schools and sports and stuff like that, and how many times there might be something going on that we don't see, you know, and how do you intervene?
Exactly, because you don't want to be a busybody. You don't want to stick your nose in where it doesn't belong. That's what we've been taught our whole lives, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yet there probably are kids out there who really need somebody to stick their nose in.
Yeah.
And how do you know? You know, at least now there are mandatory reporting laws
mm-hmm.
that I don't know if they were in effect when you were a child. They certainly were not when I was a child. That maybe will catch some of this type of situation.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah. Yeah. So Tell me, talk a little bit about what it was like to lose your brother when you, in some ways, you never really had a brother.
Yeah, I think it made for some complicated grief. And it's something that people don't really talk about a lot. When your relationship with somebody while they're alive is complicated, your relationship doesn't become any less complicated after they die. And what happens is you kind of inherit all the unanswered questions, all the unfinished business. I think I wrote in the book, even though I knew that because of his intellectual disabilities, he was not capable of having a deep, meaningful conversation about what we meant to one another, I still had this feeling like we'd run out of time. Like that, it was kind of magical thinking. Like I still believed someday that we would be able to sit down and talk about our difficult childhood and kind of work it all out. And even though I knew that wasn't possible. And so losing him, obviously I was grieving the loss of my brother, who I loved and still love very deeply, but I was grieving all the loss of possibility, the loss of the way it should have been, and the loss of any sort of shared future.
What's one of your fondest memories with your brother?
I always talk about his love of Christmas. One of the characteristics of Prader-Willi syndrome is almost an obsessive sort of personality. There's some kind of OCD traits that go along with the condition. And for Alan, that showed up in really endearing ways. He was obsessed with Christmas. He year-round would listen to classic Christmas albums like Bing Crosby on his Walkman tape player with headphones, and he would sing along, which for Alan, singing sounded like shouting. So he was basically shouting Christmas music at us year round with so much joy. And he believed in Santa Claus until the day he died. And so that's always been a really warm memory for me, is just his unbridled joy around Christmas. Other things, he was really gentle and sweet with dogs, especially. Like, I think, if he had been able-bodied, he might have chosen a career working with animals for, how much he adored taking care of animals. And other things, cars, movies, he would watch the same movies, especially if they had dogs in them, over and over and over again. So yeah, it was fun to watch.
Well, so one of the things that that you talk about is the need for mental health care for those providing care for disabled loved ones. Are there, have you found more resources for that as, now than there was when you needed it?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I can't speak to parents, although I'm seeing a lot of organizations out there that are supporting parents of children with all sorts of disabilities, visible and invisible. And then from a sibling perspective, there are groups. There's the Sibling Leadership Network, which is a nationwide organization that's designed specifically to support siblings of people with disabilities or chronic medical conditions. And they have online support groups and in-person meetings. There are some forums where siblings can go and talk about caregiving, because a lot of times siblings, especially in adulthood, become the default caregivers, especially as parents are aging and unable to fulfill that role. So there's some really great resources in terms of sibling support and parents. Yeah, I mean, I don't know how it would have been if my mother had a Facebook group to go to,
Oh,
to
yeah.
maybe get some validation. I think she certainly could have benefited from having some sort of community and a place where she could admit her struggles.
She must have felt very alone.
I imagine, yeah.
Yeah. And just the idea, you know, as a mother, you have such high hopes for your kids from the moment they're born. And to have those, in her case with your brother, those hopes were dashed almost immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And then her entire focus seemed to be your brother. And, but not in a healthy way.
Right.
And it's just, it's hard to, and in fact, in some ways, it almost feels like as you write, and maybe you didn't mean this, but so correct me if I'm wrong, but it almost felt like your mother encouraged his disability.
Yeah, I certainly think she drew a lot of her identity and self-esteem from being his mother and his disability. And I mean, I could speculate all day
about
what
yeah.
exactly was going on, but that's what I observed. And I think, you know, I think she probably was desperate for some care and attention. And my brother was one way to get that.
Yeah, even though often the attention might not have been very positive, or it's pity, comes as pity, but maybe that's better than nothing. There's one scene in the book where you and your younger brother, Will, are, as adults, trying to talk to your mother about what's going to happen with Alan once she's no longer able to care for him. And she's just not even willing to look at it, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And as I've connected with other siblings, that's surprisingly common. There's a lot of parents out there that don't want to face the prospect of, you know, what's going to happen to their child who needs around-the-clock care when they're no longer able to provide it. End-of-life planning or elder care planning for people with disabilities in families is not talked about enough. So, yeah, it was really upsetting and disappointing when my mother said that she had no plan and that she kind of expected us to step up and take care of him, but that's really, really common.
I just can't imagine what it would be like growing up with that, knowing that that expectation was always there. And knowing that if you don't do it, some people are going to see you as selfish or
mm-hmm.
something. But it's like, but how can you gear your whole life around the idea of having to take care of somebody else like that?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's these things are not black and white. I think one thing that I learned is that you can love someone and you can have compassion for them without sacrificing yourself in the process. And in the case of my brother, the decision was made easier by the fact that I have my own children now. And so I was not willing to put them in harm's way in
Right.
the same way that I had been as a child. So there was a safety issue that made it clearer for me. It made it a little easier to say, no, I'm not going to do that.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Gina DeMillo Wagner, author of Forces of Nature, a memoir of family, loss, and finding home. You know, one thing you mentioned is that the syndrome that your brother had, and what was it called again?
Prader-Willi.
Prader-Willi. How many people have that? How prevalent is it?
Let's see. I actually think I have a statistic. I think it's about 1 in 20 or 30,000 births. It's pretty rare.
Wow. It's not something I had ever heard of before. But one of the symptoms is basically inability to control behavior and resulting in sometimes violent behavior. And that leads me, when I read about that, it leads me to, okay, so there must be all kinds of gradations of and reasons of why people are really unable to control behavior. And where do we, you know, who do we look at and say, okay, they can't help being that way? And mm-hmm. who do we look at and say, I blame you for being that way? And where is that line?
Yeah. Is there accountability?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's made even more complicated by the fact that, like most genetic disorders, there's a spectrum of presentations. So Alan, my brother, might have been on the more extreme end of the spectrum in terms of the behavioral issues. I've heard of adults living with Prader-Willi who have managed it. There's more treatments now than there were when we were growing up. But there's plenty of people who are living with Prader-Willi who are not having the same level of behavioral issues. And then, you know, the other thing I want to say is that my parents always suspected that there were other issues that my brother had. He actually wasn't diagnosed with Prader-Willi until he was in his 30s. It was the first time a doctor had kind of put two and two together and suggested genetic testing. So before that, we knew he had some profound disabilities, but we didn't have any context for it. So we didn't know what was normal and what to expect. And we didn't know what he could control and what he couldn't control.
Wow, that must have made it even harder.
Not knowing,
yeah, yeah.
Yeah, there wasn't a handbook that said, okay, you can expect your child to do this by this age, or this is what their long-term prognosis is. We didn't really have that.
Wow. You know, now currently there's a lot of talk about neurodivergence, and mm-hmm. this in a way, your brother seemed to be an example of extreme neurodivergence. And again, it goes back to, okay, so people who are neurodivergent aren't intentionally different, aren't intentionally processing things in a different way that results in maybe different behaviors. And so where do we draw the line between just accepting them as they are or holding them accountable? Now, obviously, when it comes to violent behavior, that has to be a line that's drawn in some way.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't actually, I don't really feel like you blame your brother even for that.
I don't. And part of it too, you know, I don't know how much this is still the case, but when we were growing up, doctors would assign him an intellectual age. So, you know, he had his physical age and he was growing physically. And then doctors would say things like, you know, intellectually or mentally, he's 5 years old. And I don't know if that's the best way to label someone's development, but it was a helpful context for me as a kid and into adulthood. Because then you think about what can you expect from a 5-year-old who's having a temper tantrum? I mean, if how much can they control it? How much can you redirect them? The difference was he was twice as big as me and in an adult body when it was happening.
Right. Did you ever sustain serious injuries?
I had certainly a lot of bruises. I had a couple of bald spots where he pulled my hair out. I never went to the doctor for anything, so I can't say how severe anything was. But yeah, I definitely had some lasting bruises and soreness from him punching or kicking me.
And then he'd be sorry?
Immediately. It really felt like, and Prader-Willi impacts a person's hormones and pituitary gland. It's a mutation on chromosome 15. So it really was almost like a hormonal surge, like a circuit breaker that surged, and then he would kind of return to baseline and feel remorse. He would see me crying or bleeding and immediately feel remorse.
Wow. So let's talk a little bit about the writing process for you. Now, you're a journalist. Were you still working full time as you were writing this?
I was working full time. I was actually working in a corporate setting at the time in kind of a content marketing role. So yeah, it was a challenge to find time to write.
and you had two small children.
Two children, yep. So I was stealing every little 15-minute block of time that I could find. I had a legal pad that I kept on my desk at the office, and sometimes a thought would occur to me and I would write it down, or I would go for a walk on my lunch break and I would talk into the notes app on my phone. I would just use the voice to text and I would capture, you know, thoughts or sentences that way. And I would wake up before work and try to write for an hour before going in or on the weekends. And then ultimately what happened as I got further into the manuscript, I used some vacation days and checked myself into a cabin that had no Wi-Fi and no television. And I just was able to kind of spend a few days uninterrupted to knock out the rest of the manuscript.
Well, that would take some discipline, I think, to do.
Yeah, I think, I mean, one thing I really want to emphasize, because I think so many people want to write a book and they think that they're going to wait until they have time or they're going to find a block of time to get it done. And that's just not possible for a lot of people. And I want to say it can be done. It can be done in little chunks of time.
And over how long a period?
That first draft probably took me about a year.
Oh, that's not bad. I mean, I've had authors who've taken 10 years or more. Sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, that was the first draft from start to finish. Cause I wrote the first draft. I'm really fortunate that I have a wonderful literary agent who worked with me on some revisions. Start to finish, I think the entire process has been about 5 years from that first draft to publication.
So how did you find your agent, which often is talked about as the most difficult part of the publishing process?
Yeah. I pitched like most people. I did have a little bit of a connection because I'd taken some workshops and classes with a couple of authors who, you know, said, hey, I think actually you would be a great fit for this agency. So you know, that might have helped my query get read a little bit faster, but ultimately I sent a pitch and a sample of my work and then heard back from my agent that way.
Now, did you wait until you had the first draft complete before you pitched?
I didn't. So I had written at that point this essay for the New York Times, which had gotten some attention. And then I had about 75% of the manuscript written when I first reached out. And I actually signed with my agent before I finished the last bit of it. And she was able to kind of help me shape the ending.
I would imagine that the New York Times article was a big plus in getting an agent and also eventual publication. How did you get published, to get this essay published in the New York Times?
That was another cold pitch. As a journalist, I've gotten really comfortable with researching different publications and writing, kind of tailoring what I'm writing for that publication. So in the case of the New York Times, I wanted to write an essay about my experience of being a sibling and losing my brother. And what I did was a lot of essays for the New York Times, you write them first, you submit them on spec. So I pretended like I already had the assignment. I wrote it as if it was for them, as if they had assigned it to me, which I think helped me kind of drop into the voice of the New York Times and think about what the headline might be. And so when I sent in the pitch, I used the headline as the subject line, and I sent the essay, and they accepted it pretty quickly, like within a few weeks, and they ended up using my headline. So I think my advice would be for anyone who wants to try to publish a book or, publish anything to get some attention to their writing is to just kind of drop into what the publication needs and drop into that voice and try to match it as much as you can.
And why in particular did you choose the New York Times as where you were going for the with this essay?
I pitched it to their well section. They had a column called Ties that was all about different kinds of family relationships. And so I felt like that would be a really great venue for the story that I wanted to tell. And it doesn't hurt that it's a huge audience.
Absolutely. So knowing the market is really, and who's publishing what and what they're looking for is really an important part of becoming a successful writer.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And
Now,
publishing essays that are related, especially if you're writing memoir, publishing essays that are related to the topic of your memoir is a great way to get some attention and kind of help move the process along.
what other type of freelance writing have you done?
I worked as an editor for many years at different outdoor and travel magazines. So I've done a lot of work and freelance in that area. And I continue, even with this memoir, I continue to kind of bring in nature and the outdoors into my writing because it's such a core part of who I am. So yeah, I write anything from travel pieces to now I'm kind of shifting more towards personal essays that kind of blend nature and the human experience.
Did you have much experience in the outdoors as a child?
I always kind of looked at the outdoors as a refuge. I mean, I participated in Girl Scouts. I did some camping and hiking trips. But really, it was going outside in my backyard was a refuge for me. Inside was not safe. It was chaotic. I kind of figured out at a very young age that I could go outside and I could stand in the grass and I could feel the wind on my face and I could listen to the birds and it calmed my nervous system. And so I think that kind of planted a seed for me to really try to spend as much time outdoors as possible. And then, as a teenager and certainly in my 20s, I was backpacking and hiking and visiting waterfalls and doing anything I could to be outdoors.
You also wrote about a hike that your father took you on when you were really young.
Yes. When I got to spend time with my dad, we would, he would try to do fun things with us since we didn't see him very often. But yeah, he took me on some hikes when I was younger too.
So, back to the writing and publishing process. So you had your first draft and then, how long did you spend sort of polishing that before you started sending it out to publishers?
It was probably another year. I was polishing that draft and then also developing a proposal with my agent.
And what were some of the main ways that the book changed from the first draft to the final version?
I think I added, I mean, I know I added quite a bit. And this is probably again my journalism training. I tend to be pretty economical with my words. And so I remember my agent marking in several places, I want to hear more. I want to hear more. Expand on this. Expand on this. So I feel like there was a process of going through and just kind of layering a little bit more, adding a scene or adding more details. There wasn't any sort of major structural overhauls that happened, which I feel fortunate. I've had friends and I've watched them have to kind of completely rip things apart. And
So even the first draft had the same basic structure.
yes,
Yeah,
yeah.
yeah. And were there things that you ended up writing about that maybe you were hesitant to write about initially?
Not really. I mean, I really feel a lot of that happened before I started writing, in terms of setting boundaries and deciding where I was going to go and where I wasn't going to go.
Okay.
So by the time I really was getting into it, I felt pretty comfortable with the story that I was writing.
Great. Did you have any family members read it before publication to like check whether there might be factual things that needed that they had different recollections of?
I did a lot of interviews. I didn't send anyone the work in progress to read, but I did a lot of interviewing folks who were involved, who were there, and kind of fact checking through different conversations that I had.
And of course, you had your journals, which
Yes.
helped you remember things correctly. That was,
Yes.
yeah. One of the kind of the driving themes throughout the book was this idea that you really wanted to know what really happened, how your brother really died. Tell me a little bit about why that was such so important to you to know, and whether or not you ever got resolution.
I think it was important on a lot of different levels. I think, when you're in those early phases of grief, I think your mind latches on to something almost as a way to kind of avoid the real question or the real pain that you're experiencing. So trying to figure out exactly what went wrong felt like a focus that I could have that would keep me busy and kind of keep me maybe from really looking at the real question, which is what did I lose when he died, I did wonder what went wrong in terms of, had I done enough as his sister? Had my mother taken good care of him? Did the systems that are designed to protect him fail in some way? So there's some very real questions around that. And as you know, some of those have answers and some don't. But ultimately, for me, the grieving process was kind of getting comfortable with those questions themselves. I think there's this myth that in grief, there's a finish line. You arrive at acceptance and suddenly everything is clear and resolved. And that wasn't my experience. And I actually don't think it's most people's experience. I don't think you ever get to this final resting place where, you've accepted everything. I think you can make peace with the loss and I think you can move forward with it. And acceptance might be more of a rest stop than a final destination. So yeah, I mean it was an important part of my process, I think, to investigate and to understand that I had done everything in my power, both before he died and after, to try to get those answers for him.
Wow. So when you wrote, you had your draft, you modified it over the next year, and then you started sending it out. What kind of responses did you get, and was it difficult to find a publisher?
It was difficult in large part because we tried to send it out in early 2020. So,
Oh.
and things did not go as planned. Initially, I think we had it all ready to go out in March or April of 2020, and my agent sent it out to a limited number of editors. And then, it wasn't just COVID, it was all the social justice things that were happening. We pulled it back and we just said, okay, this is not the right time. And then it's the election. And so it was definitely a long, drawn out process
I mean,
that was
they
made
weren't
harder.
even actually publishing books during 2020.
It was, yeah, there was, people didn't want to look at anything. I mean, they were so overwhelmed.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, to have a story that's a little more emotional, you know, people didn't really have capacity for that.
Wow. Wow.
So we tried again in 2021. Again, just kind of a limited submission. And then ultimately, it was, gosh, probably summer of 2022 that we finally got some interest from publishers.
And then so this is your first published book?
Yes.
Yes. And will there be more?
I hope so. Yeah. I am working on a series of essays right now that I hope to publish as a collection someday. And yeah, we'll see what else. There's a lot of people have asked me to write a memoir specifically about my relationship with my mother, which we'll see.
Well, is it hard sometimes going back, revisiting the pain that you're writing about?
Yes and no. I think for me, I had done so much healing work and processing off the page that by the time I sat down to write, it wasn't like I was reopening old wounds. And I developed also some self-care around it too, in terms of just kind of blocking out my time as much as I could. I learned, you know, that if I wrote a scene that was really emotionally charged, I should do something immediately afterwards. I should go for a hike. I should go swim laps at the rec center. I needed to do something to kind of move my body afterwards to kind of clear my nervous system.
Well, yeah, I can see why people might want you to write about your mother, but I could see where that might not be something you'd want to do.
No, not yet.
So, Forces of Nature, Gina DeMillo Wagner, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. And, you know, we always end our interviews with a quote, and I had one that I was going to use, but then from what you said just a few minutes ago, I decided I'll go with this one from Renata Suzuki. When you experience loss, people say you'll move through 5 stages of grief: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. What they don't tell you is that you'll cycle through them all every day.
Hmm.
So sure. Sounds like you might know what she's talking about.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, thank you. And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Thank you so much.